thing is, we didn't discuss this morning, I completely forgot about it, but tomorrow's Odad Shasti. There's this whole program going on up there with Janani Vas and doing a whole program. So I was just wondering what we should do about the classes. If we should run the class, because morning means, I think it's specifically morning. I know at 8 o'clock it starts, I think it goes all the way through lunch. So is anybody planning to go to that or
no?
Not so much? No? You were planning.
Not really. I didn't know.
Oh, you didn't know. Now you've heard about it. Okay.
So that's
a program tomorrow.
Sorry?
There is another program tomorrow. It is a Vyasa Puja of Srila Bhakti Sarupananda.
Oh, okay. So it's two programs tomorrow.
So we do a function of the Navadvip.
Oh, in Navadvip. Okay. At the Manipur one. So I guess it didn't.
Just to make it easier, the decision.
Yeah, no, but it didn't. Vive la France there. I guess it didn't quite. Yeah. I don't know, because it means basically as if others were going, because I know a lot of the community is going to the program. Mm-hmm. But if it's not happening here, then. Why does this have cuts of it? Oh, well. Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu
Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivastari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
It's interesting, once Guruji Prabhu mentioned to us that the more options people have, the less they use.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah, if you only have one option, generally it's everybody takes it. Okay.
For us, it wasn't even an option. We didn't even know about it.
Oh, okay. I thought it was more of a comment. Common knowledge. Okay. So modifications of the mind. We did that. Now we're on Abhideya. Right. Okay. So then the modifications. Okay. Yeah. Five classes: valid cognition, this is 21, invalid cognition, verbal cognition, sleep, and memory. So those are the five modifications of what the mind goes through. So memory will be the samskaras, you know, what you remember from previous, what's going on from there. Sleep, then that's basically either one's not conscious of anything or one's putting together all kinds of things from one's, the other cognitions, and making it into something, you know, amusing. Verbal cognition, you're simply saying that it's going to be great and nice, so it's not necessarily the fact, right? Invalid cognition then means it's not actually proper. It doesn't have a proper source or proper mechanics or anything. Valid cognition will be it's based on authority, right? It's based on authority. and it has the proper mechanics that it's going through. Mm. So that's the only one that's actually really proper, like that. It means memory, if it's good memories like that, then it's okay, like that. So, okay. Okay, so then here, then we have, okay, then all the thoughts, emotions, mental behaviors fall into these five categories, which are further divided into two major types, right? So it means you have those that cause afflictions and those that do not cause afflictions. False cognition, verbal cognition, and sleep always cause afflictions and are in themselves afflictions. They are harmful modifications, right? So you're trying to control those. Valid cognition and memories, depending on their nature, are not considered to be causes of affliction and are not harmful for meditation. Right? So two of them are useful. Right? In other words, valid cognition and memory are useful. Right? If the memory is on useful things, if it's memories of stupid things, like taking your friend and sticking his head in the mud or something, that's not necessarily going to be overly useful like that. I mean, if you figured out after that he stuck your head in the mud, so therefore don't stick people's head in the mud, then that may be something useful. Right?
Yeah. On a low level.
Lower level, okay. I thought you were going to say, yeah, I can relate to that. I knew that guy.
Yeah. He's not around anymore.
Okay.
What's the problem with
verbal cognition? Verbal cognition here is just the definition. In other words, you have something that you're defining, and you have to have words to define it. So this is the words that they're using. But verbal cognition, where was that defined? That's within modifications. I think it's defined within this section itself. Okay. Verbal cognition is the attempt to grasp something that actually does not exist, but is one's own projection. That's it. It doesn't mean that verbally then you went through and then you understood it. Because that's part of valid cognition.
So it's projection.
It might be, but it doesn't mean, it's more of the thing it doesn't exist. An example of such a projection. Yeah, he has this fabulous one. Where he got this one, I don't know. But I guess gossamer winged fairies just means fairies always have gossamer wings, right? They're all different things like that. Angels have solid wings, but things like this are like, what do you call those? Like a dragonfly wings. Those kind of, like that. Point is that, dragonfly wings won't carry both of you. It's something that you've projected, right? Does that make sense? He's still learning about the fairy itself.
Okay. She's thinking, I'd like some wings.
Okay, yeah. So in other words, it's something that doesn't exist. So you have ultimately the idea that I can be happy in the material world is a verbal cognition. And everybody's saying, yes, this and that, or an advertisement's a verbal cognition. Like that. So you may have elements that are facts. What I'm saying? Facts like, fairies have gossamer wings, right? But the point is how you put it all together. Because the mind can only work with elements that it finds within the world. What you've perceived is what you will use. Like the golden mountain, even though it doesn't exist, but gold exists and mountains exist, but you put them together, that's the verbal cognition. Like that. So in other words, the verbal cognition and, the dream state are fairly similar, kind of. Does that make sense? Because you're able to understand something or a perception through the verbal, by hearing, that's all defined as shabda. That will be invalid cognition. I hear from Shastra that the material world is a place of misery, so I understand that, but that's valid cognition. But verbal cognition simply means because you've said it, therefore it's fact. Does that make sense?
So not telling truth will also fall into this?
Yeah, but the telling the truth is the mechanics for something. You know, so it can be. But it basically means is that your concept of what will create your happiness is not real. You know, so anything material, it's not real. So that's the whole point is in yoga, you're removing the whole material endeavor. And then just focusing on your only endeavors through yoga, you know, with proper valid cognition. So in other words, invalid cognition, you're taking off of things that aren't real. And then you're verbally putting them together into something even more unreal, right? And then sleep, that's trying to be controlled. So those things are there. So you're trying to use authority, and you're using you know, the memories from before. It means you're taking your practical experiences and trying to see them through the eyes of authority. Does that make sense? So Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So then that gives the whole point. So in other words, Shastra Chakshus means you're seeing through the eyes of Shastra, but what you're using to as examples of what you're seeing is your previous experience. Right? Or the experiences that you're gaining now. You know, because basically within 1/11th of a second, anything turns into a memory. You know, but if it's immediate, you don't call it a memory. You know what I'm saying? But anything that's happening right now, just within the time, is counted as present. Though technically, only 1/11th, a window of 1/11th of a second is the present. That's actually how big the present is. No. But as far as for speaking and interacting, you talk about everything that's going on now is present. You know what I'm saying? Like you just said, not much. Even though that's now in the past, you'll count that as present because that's part of the present interaction. That makes sense. But when this is over, then that'll be past. Does that make sense? So that's just the culture. That's at least how it's defined by Sanskrit. Does that make sense? But it's different from when you're working. You have to work with what's happening in that 11th of a second. You know, and connect that with what's happening just around it. But your actual focus has to be on what's happening right now. Then it works. It's successful.
So basically in the material world, everything is verbal. It's based on verbal cognition.
In other words, anything other than pure bhakti as defined by the acharyas in the scriptures is verbal cognition. Right? The Vedas are real. But if you perceive them as, by doing this karmakanda yoga, I will be happy in this world, that aspect that I'll be happy is verbal cognition. That I do the yoga and I will be elevated to the heavenly planets, that's valid cognition, that's authority. But that I'll be happy by that, that's verbal cognition. Right? Because that's what Prahlad Maharaj said, in the material world, it's shruti sukhat. It's the happiness we've heard about. Because that's the whole thing. You hear about it. But, you know, who's experienced it? You know? The point is, someone's experienced it. They're telling you, oh, yeah, it was so great. We were on the boat, and it was so nice, and the sun, and the wind, and the waves. But you're only hearing about it. You know? Because when you go there, it's not necessarily that. Because how much did they spend on that cruise? Right? Right? And so are they going to say it was a complete waste of time? No. And since they don't have anything else of reality to compare it to, all they have is verbal cognition. So it was a better verbal cognition than other verbal cognitions. You know? So, therefore, you only hear about it, or it's in the magazine, or, you know, you only hear about it. That's the thing. So that's why associated with Vaishnavas, and hearing about the name, form, qualities, and pastimes of the Lord, that's valid cognition. But basically everything else that Matthew was saying is prajalpa, that would be verbal cognition. It's not that it's not that they're not facts. It's not that it's not true that this one did that and that one did this and this one said that and that one said this. Those are all true. But the point is that those are a cause of anxiety or a cause of happiness for myself. That's verbal cognition, because they have nothing to do with the soul. Right. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's what I'm making.
So you could take the element of Nainitya, Kennitya.
Yes, yes, Yes. But even you do have naimittic that is valid. You know, because, I mean, following the Shastra and doing all the things, following the lifestyle, that's all valid. You're following authority, but your reason for doing it is not. Just like, means the you have the smarta performing, you know, worship of Vishnu for karmakanda. You have the smarta performing worship of Vishnu for jnanakanda. Yeah, and you have the devotee who's worshiping Vishnu for bhakti. So the mechanics may be correct, but then where the verbal comes in is that by merging in the Brahman, I'll be happy, or by going to heavenly planets, I'll be happy. That's the point. No, but by performing, worshipping Vishnu, whatever it is you want to gain, you'll get. That's real. Does that make sense? Yeah. But that you'll be happy with anything other than bhakti, that's actually verbal cognition. So depending upon the circle, you'll take it smaller or bigger. You know, but from Vedanta, you'll take basically the whole material environment as verbal cognition. It's a fact. That's why we say in the Bhagavatam it opens that the material world is illusory. It means the idea that I can enjoy here, that's illusory. That the material world exists, that's a fact. Right? So sometimes we talk about it as being a fact, sometimes we talk about it as illusory. What we're meaning is that its existence is factual, but the idea that the soul can be happy here, that's illusory. But because that's what one's working on, therefore we say the whole thing's illusion. You know what I'm saying? That I have my house, that I have my money, I have my family, that's real. But that's going to make the soul happy, that's an illusion. Oh. That's a horse, not a cow. I says, where did we get the black and white slim, cow?
Slim black and white
cow. Yeah, and then I noticed now it's a horse. Okay.
Good thing you didn't go to milk it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rajaram.
Rajaram, okay. Is that okay? You know, so it's just on the bigger, just like on if you're dealing on the platform of karma kanda, then vikarma would be verbal cognition, right? Because it means if you don't follow the Veda, that you can be happy is an illusion. You have to follow the Veda. Then the point is then on the platform of jnana kanda, then the karma kanda would be the verbal cognition, that I'll be happy, I'll go to heavenly planets. That's not real. Like that. But on the platform of bhakti, then all the others are verbal cognition. Does that work?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. 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 Valid cognition are perception, inference, and authoritative testimony, which has already been described in the Shankya chapter. You know, all the others have dealt with these. So perception means what you're getting with the senses. Inference is what you can see two out of three items, but you can connect the third item to one of the other two, and therefore then make a connection between them. Right? You know, in other words, you can know the unknown through the known. Right? So you're dealing with what is the nature of something, and you're dealing with what you can perceive. So it's kind of like in between authority and in between perception, right? Okay. And authoritative testimony means what's coming from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, but it has to be based on Shastra, right? It means if you're dealing with someone who doesn't accept Shastra, then it's being is by someone who is an apta, which means he is someone who knows the field very well and has the character that what they speak would be worth taking. So you can still use that principle of authority even with those who don't accept the Shastra. You just have to drop it down to the Nyaya level to do it. Right? But here, but at this point, then you're already accepting Shastra. Right? Okay. False cognition is ignorance, avidya. Ignorance is mistaking the non-eternal for the eternal, the impure for the pure, misery for happiness, and the non-self for the self. It is the modification of mind that is the mother of the kleshas or afflictions. Ignorance has four offshoots: asmita, which is generally defined as I am-ness; raga, attachment or addiction, which is the desire to prolong or repeat pleasurable experiences. This is a very nice definition, right? Yeah. The desire to prolong or repeat pleasurable experiences. That's attachment.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's the whole thing. You're attached to something because of the experience you can gain from it. And you want to, you know, and repeat that, right? Dvesha, hate or aversion, which is the desire to avoid unpleasurable experiences, right? Mm. The opposite. And abhinivesha, fear of death. Right? So, in other words, there's the I-ness, and then that goes with fear of death, because it's the I-ness that will die. Mm. You know, because I am this body, I am from this country, I am from all these different elements. Those are the things that are going to die, are going to stop, right? And then the opposite of the pleasurable is the unpleasurable, right? So always the duality. So that's the thing, is that modification of the mind and ignorance creates these dualities that are a problem. Verbal cognition, okay, we went through that. All such fantasies are mere verbal cognition that do not correspond to facts, and only cause the mind to fluctuate. Sleep is the modification of mind in which, when he says not facts, means how you put it together is not factual. It's made up of facts, because you can't put together anything that's not.
Yeah.
You know, means that you have a unicorn, that unicorn it doesn't exist, but you've seen a horse, and you've seen, you know, the antelope horn. So all it is, you put the antelope horn instead of on the deer, you know, and two of them, you put one of them on a horse. How come the horse doesn't get two? Why it only gets one? You know, why there's no antelopes with only one? Why it's only deers have, horses have one? You know, so these major, major, you know, points of discussion here.
I was thinking rhinoceros.
Rhinoceros with an antelope horn.
No, just an elegant rhinoceros. That's
an elegant rhinoceros. Well, they have two, but then they're in a line.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe the other one is very, very small.
Okay.
We have to get close to a unicorn.
Yeah, but, you know, why not a cat or...
Who's to say they
an armadillo, exist? You know, I say something like that. And then if they rolled up, then you'd have a club.
That would be... See, now we're getting somewhere.
You know, like that. You know. Yeah. Okay, sleep is a modification of mind in which one's relationship with the external world is cut off. One might ask, if sleep is a modification of mind, aren't the dreaming and waking stages also accepted as modifications? The answer would be no. The dreaming state is occupied with verbal cognition, and the waking state is occupied mainly with valid and invalid cognition. Right? Does that make sense? Because otherwise, when you say, okay, well, waking and asleep, so wouldn't those both be? No, but it's just sleeping. Because awake, then you're dealing with verbal, means these other means valid and invalid. And verbal, then specifically sleep deals with that.
Yeah.
Though, a lot of times, one deals with it in the waking state. Because there's also the point here, is that what you're mentioning here, is that there's also avidya, ignorance. Non-eternal for the eternal, impure for the pure, misery for happiness, non-self for the self. So a lot of times, then, in prajalpa, a lot of times it's ignorance that's being discussed. You know, something that's actually good, you say, is that's bad, and something that's bad, you say, is good. And does that make sense? So it's kind of like you could say a combination of those. Okay. Memory, the fifth and final mental modification, is the recall of impressions stored in the mind. So now if those impressions are good, it'll be beneficial. The impressions are bad, it's not. So that's why one wants to be careful what impressions are in the mind.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. There's that saying, you can't unsee it.
Another fun definition of anartha is that anartha is the fond memory of sense gratification.
The fond memory of sense gratification. Anartha. The fond memory of sense gratification. Yeah, because it's something you want to do again. Yeah. The fond memory of sense gratification. We should somehow have a book with all these definitions written down. They're really good. You know? Okay, so now with that, now we can move into the Abhideya. Like that. So the Abhideya is overcoming the modifications. Okay, so that was all in Sambandha. Now, those, the whole system is based on understanding and knowing these elements. So now Abhideya will be using these elements. Yeah. The modifications of the mind are caused by 9 conditions or impediments. Right? It just keeps getting more and more. Right? Everything does. It's just a matter of whether you know it or not.
Yeah. You know. That's true.
Does that make sense? It means it's a science. There's a lot of things, like when the guy is saying something, you know, and the lady says, you don't understand, because there's all these other modifications that you're not considering. Like that. So, here are the 9 conditions, right? Sickness, incompetence, doubt, delusion, sloth, non-abstentation, confusion, non-attainment of the desired state, and instability in an attained state. These impediments disturb the mind and produce sorrow, dejection, restlessness, and an unrhythmic beating pattern. Yoga provides... Okay. So the modification of the mind means that 9 conditions. In other words, you can take all those other ones and then put them in these kind of things. Because in sickness, then it becomes disturbed. Like that. Incompetence. Right? Things don't work out, so then nothing goes nicely. Doubt. You know, then you can't function. Delusion means you don't actually know what should be done or not done. Sloth, you're lazy. You know, non-abstentation means things that you shouldn't do, you're doing. Because something you shouldn't do means the other ones is that you're incompetence, doubt, delusion. You're not doing things that you should do, but non-abstentation, you're doing things you shouldn't do. Confusion. Right, means you can't tell. Doubt is you have an idea but you're not quite sure, but confusion, you can't tell which is right or not. You means doubt, at least you have an idea that this is supposed to be right, that's supposed to be wrong, but you doubt it. But confusion, either one of them could be right, either one could be wrong. Yes.
Delusion
and confusion. Delusion would be, I would say, is you take it to the other way. Now something that's wrong, you say is right. Yeah. Right? Doubt is that there may be something right, but and something wrong, but you're not. You can't quite understand it. Right? So it's more in the positive. Confusion means it's on that neutral state because you can't tell which is which, and then delusion would be go into the negative. It means that you think something that's wrong is right, something that's right is wrong. Non-attainment of the desired state, right? So when you're incompetent, then you don't get what you want, you know, then there's a problem, right? The mind becomes unstable. And instability in an attained state. You get to that state, but you can't maintain it, right? So you're either stuck in a position where you can't get anything done, or you can't stay in a position where you can get something done. So these are all the 9 problems. These impediments disturb the mind and produce sorrow. So the results is sorrow, dejection, restlessness, and unrhythmic breathing pattern. So you don't breathe regularly because of this. Because of the lack of breathing, the mind is more disturbed. Boy, the winter fuzz is everywhere. Everything's fuzzy.
Right, they produce feelings, no? Sorrow.
Yeah.
So the feelings are very connected to the mind.
Yeah, no, it's all the mind. The mind is, that's what I was saying before. What was it saying? All thoughts, emotions, and mental behaviors fall into these 5 categories. So it's just a matter of which one is falling into. So then things like delusion, sloth, confusion, these kind of things would be naturally in your invalid cognition, or delusion might even be a verbal cognition. It means all of these fall into these. But in considering it, you have to understand that these are there. So these nine, like that. So these could be put into. Yoga provides a method for overcoming these problems and controlling the modifications of the mind. Patanjali states that the mind and its modifications can be controlled through practice, abhyasa, and detachment, vairagya. Footnote 12. Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna states, O mighty armed Kunti, it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by suitable practice and detachment. Right? In other words, we're talking about yoga here. So you have the general of yoga, right? And then you have the particular detail that makes it Astanga yoga, or bhakti yoga. Right? Does that make sense? So in principle, they'll be the same. Yoga is yoga. That's why Krishna's before say, always be a yogi. But of the yogis, the best is one who's always thinking of him. Right? In affection. Because otherwise, the Astanga yogi is always thinking of him, but not with affection. Like that. So he's not the best yogi. Right.
So in our case, what would be the practice and detachment?
For us, detachment basically means the results not for us. The results for Krishna.
And the practice?
Practice would be that particular medium, that particular endeavor that produces a result, right, that we're detached from. Does that make sense? So it can be anything. It can be the activities in the family, it can be activities in business, it can be activities in the sadhana. Right? In other words, you're going out distributing books, but you're detached from the idea that everybody will say you're a great book distributor, or that they'll say you're useless. You know? Like that. So the practice is whatever it is that you're doing. But the practice being that you're practicing doing it for Krishna. So doing it for Krishna means you're doing the activity for Krishna, so you're trying to improve the quality of the activity, but you're also trying to improve the quality of that of sacrifice, that the result is for Krishna. So in other words, the principle of sacrifice, it has these two, practice and detachment. The sacrifice means you're performing the activity, and the result is for someone else's benefit. Does that make sense? So the devotional process already includes these. That's why we don't have to separately endeavor. But we bring it out because occasionally, whenever it comes up, we don't become distracted by our attachments. What did he say again? Fond memories.
Of sense
gratification. You know what I'm saying? So because of that, we become distracted. So then we have to mechanically go through, no, I'm doing this for Krishna. You know what I'm saying? Then it puts it into perspective. And then when that goes, then by that practice of practicing, then it comes to where it just naturally does. The spontaneous means the practice is there, and now the mood is going. So the practice is strong, and the detachment is strong. So it works very nicely. Is that okay?
So it doesn't really matter whether it is direct or indirect.
No.
It's the connection.
You'll have more difficulties with indirect than with direct. Like sitting and chanting japa, there's generally less things that can go wrong. And even if it does go wrong, you're still connected. It's still yoga because you're chanting the Lord's name, though maybe you're not thinking of the Lord. But with indirect, when you connect them, then you get the devotional benefit. But when it disconnects, you don't get the devotional benefit. Though it's still Krishna, but Krishna only personally enters something when we recognize him there personally. Otherwise, he's already there as his energies. So he doesn't personally appear there. Does that make sense? Yeah.
All right, that recognition is in the form of consciousness. You're conscious that that's Krishna and your mind is there.
Yeah. It means it's in some way connected. Even if it's his impersonal feature, it's still Krishna the person is, it's his impersonal feature that is producing this. Does that make sense? It means Krishna is beautiful, and therefore his expansions are beautiful, so therefore, you know, whatever is created is beautiful. So it's Krishna's beauty in it, but it's non-specific to him. The tree is beautiful, the waterfall is beautiful, but it's not specifically, it's Krishna's beauty, but you're not attributing it to Krishna. So therefore it's material. Once you understand it's Krishna's beauty that makes the waterfall beautiful in that, then it's now connected to Krishna. Right? So then you get that benefit. Right? But if you leave it at that and just impressed with the waterfall, then Krishna is remaining there, but the person is remaining there in his impersonal feature. But if from that it's beautiful, and therefore it reminds you of the person, then that's actually the problem. Then it brings it to the Bhagavan. But otherwise, Bhagavan is included, because you know it's the person who is the impersonal. The impersonal, that's why it says exclusive monism, where you think there's only Brahman. That's a problem. But Krishna is expanding through everything. That's his energy. But he's still a person at the same time. Does that make sense? So, it means Radha and Krishna are sitting together, but they're not sitting together just in space or in a nice little om in a cloud, right? Like that. But even if we want to count there's an om in a cloud, still they've expanded as the om in the cloud. No? But I'm saying the whole of Vrindavan, that's all their potency. So that's the impersonal. You know what I'm saying? So the impersonal, the expansion of the realm, and them themselves as persons are going on simultaneously. But at the same time, is then that individual manifestation of energy is also a person. So even all the impersonal stuff is still people. You know what I'm saying? It means we're saying the rock and say, no, but that's impersonal, it's not a person, but it's earth, it's Bhumi Devi. Right? So there's still the personal element is still there. But it's not Krishna as the person is beyond all other persons. You know, Nityo Nitya Nam Chaitanya Chaitanya. He is the Nitya that's the source of all the other Nityas. He's beyond all the Nityas. You know, so both go on at once. But the point is it's not his expanding the realm that's impressive, it's the person that's impressive. So that's why everybody looks at Krishna. They're not, when Radha and Krishna are there, they're not looking at, wow, look at the nice trees. You know what I'm saying? The only time you hear of talking about the nice trees is when they're talking about the nice trees in connection with Krishna. You know, the forest of Vrindavan is such a great devotee that they've manifested all this wonderful thing just for Krishna's pleasure. Aren't they so pious? Aren't they wonderful? Like that. Then you're talking about that. But then you're talking about the individual. So in other words, it's not so much seeing the potency on its own without the personal element. Like that. The personal element's always being seen. So the exclusive monism, you don't see the personal element in any of it. Pretty wild. There's a horse over there. It's just wandering around and eating grass. I wonder if eventually it'll come over here and announce itself. The cow did the other day. We're here. Is that okay? Yeah. Okay. Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport, the direct difficulty in controlling the obstinate mind as expressed by Arjuna is accepted by the personality of Godhead. But at the same time, he suggests that by practice and detachment, it is possible. So just controlling it itself is going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. But by practice and detachment, then that's what's going to make it possible. Right? Just by just going in there and just the mind's not going to do this stuff, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But if you have a detached idea of what you're going to get from that, and you practice it, then it will come. Is that... What is that practice? In the present age, no one can observe the strict rules and regulations of placing oneself in a sacred place, focusing the mind on the supersoul, restraining the senses and mind, observing celibacy, remaining alone, etc. By the practice of Krishna consciousness, however, one engages in 9 types of devotional service of the Lord. The first and foremost of such devotional engagements is hearing about Krishna. This is a very powerful transcendental method for purging the mind of all misgivings. The more one hears about Krishna, the more one becomes enlightened and detached from everything that draws the mind away from Krishna. By detaching the mind from activities not devoted to the Lord, one can very easily learn vairagya. Vairagya means detachment from matter and engagement of the mind and spirit. Right? So here's a very nice definition. Right? So detachment means not that you just give it up, but you have to take it and engage it in spiritual. Right? Taking the mind from matter and engaging in spirit, that's the actual point. So when that matter is engaged in the Lord's service, then that's spirit. Yeah. Right? It's not that just giving something up, that's detachment. That's the Mayavadi's concept, because they think it's all illusion, so it's just given up. It has to be given up in connection with the Lord. Like that. So that's actual vairagya. Impersonal spiritual detachment is more difficult than attaching the mind to the activities of Krishna, because you're just giving up the one but not replacing it. That's difficult. Right? You know, the child's eating mud, so you take away the mud and give him a sandesh. That works. But take away the mud, give him nothing. That's a problem. Right? One will learn better the mud, right? So if everyone wonders, why is it the impersonal is less? Means, in other words, you have the spiritual is the best. Means in position, the mukti is there, because at least it's spiritual. But as far as actual engaging the mind, then the karma works better. Right? Like that. Because, you know, it's easy. It means the kid eats the mud, he's quiet. He eats the sandesh, he's quiet. He doesn't eat the mud or the sandesh, there's problem. So it doesn't actually work. Right? So that's another verbal cognition that mukti actually works. It's oh, we're up here. Okay. Impersonal spiritual detachment is more difficult than attaching the mind to the activities of Krishna, right? So personal spiritual detachment, in other words, it's just bringing it to the spiritual platform and leaving it with nothing. Mm-hmm. That's more difficult, right? But personal spiritual detachment, that's very easy. That's the point of attaching the mind to the activities of Krishna. In other words, because otherwise we're saying impersonal detachment and then attaching the activities to Krishna, but impersonal detachment is spiritual. But of spiritual, there's impersonal spiritual detachment and there's personal spiritual detachment. Right? Because otherwise then you could end up in a problem of definition. Right? This is practical because by hearing about Krishna, one becomes automatically attached to the Supreme Spirit. This attachment is called pareshanubhava, spiritual satisfaction. It is just like the feeling of satisfaction of a hungry man has for every morsel of food he eats. The more one eats while hungry, the more one feels satisfaction and strength. Similarly, by discharge of devotional service, one feels transcendental satisfaction as the mind becomes detached from material objects. Yeah. Means you're going to have spiritual satisfaction because you're detaching yourself from material satisfaction. Means which doesn't exist. That's a verbal cognition, right? But we're trying to get that, so therefore one's not seeing or endeavoring for spiritual. So if you regulate and connect it to Krishna, then you get that. You get the spiritual satisfaction. It is something like curing a disease by expert treatment and appropriate diet. Hearing of the transcendental activities of Lord Krishna is therefore expert treatment for the mad mind. And eating the foodstuff offered to Krishna is the appropriate diet for the suffering patient. This treatment is the process of Krishna consciousness. Okay, so if somebody's crazy, then, which means being in material consciousness, then by hearing about Krishna is the treatment, and taking prasad is the appropriate diet. So therefore, chanting, dancing, and taking prasad, that's the full treatment. This treatment is the process of Krishna consciousness. Is that you understand? So in other words, we can see is the definitions of the yoga process and the definitions of bhakti aren't dissimilar. The difficulty is in Patanjali they only take it up to a particular level. Though it's technically spiritually quite an advanced level, but it still hasn't reached the ultimate goal of the actual person. Right? So they're fully in samadhi, but not on the personality of Godhead, but on the super soul. Now, if they were in that same samadhi on the personality of Godhead, then they would move into some, as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, into sampati das. Right? They would move into the natural inheriting, that relationship, that natural relationship that they have with the Lord. They would know that relationship. Does that make sense? I thought that was very interesting, because generally we think of it as when there is sarupsiddhi, that now I know who I am. No, you don't really know who you are until you're engaged in a relationship with the Lord. Right? Does that make sense? If I know, okay, this is my name, I live at this address, these are my family members, and of the family members, this was the father, the mother, these are the brothers and sisters, this one's older, this one's younger, you know all that, but does that mean now you're experiencing those relationships? No. So you don't, until you're experiencing, that's when you say you know.
Has to be dynamic.
Yeah, so once you become fully absorbed in Krishna, then you're interacting with Krishna within that form of that relationship, then that experience comes, then you actually know your relationship with Krishna. Does that make sense?
That's in the bhava stage?
Yeah. That's in other words, the middle and means samadhi is the fifth level of the third aspect out of five. It means there's five aspects, so the third's the middle. So when it comes to samadhi, then it moves immediately into the fourth and then fifth. Right? So that means in the fourth, then you actually interact with Krishna, and then you know that relationship, so that moves to the fifth sampati. So that matures into love of God. So in other words, these last two are quite quick once you get to that. And so the slowness is in the first three. Does that make sense? I think we'll come up with details of that later. No? A lot of detail. Enough to knock you out of your chair, details. Yeah. He's like half the book. No? Yeah. So the first 20 chapters are dealing with this kind of stuff. Like what we're dealing with now. And then the last one's dealing with actually how the rasa and everything works. Because otherwise there's a lot of, like I was saying before, Swoop City, they take it, that's perfection. But that's not perfection. You know what I'm saying? That's the difference, is that the actual someone on the rag marg, it's developing love for Krishna is actually what you're looking for. But the kind of like the sahajiyas, no, if I know my rasa, then that's perfect. You understand? So that's why we're making the distinction. They take sambandha as the goal, as the sadhya, rather than prayojana, of love of God as the sadhya. I mean, so of course, if you say, they'll say, oh, no, it's love of God. No. But in their activity, they actually are taking that as the problem. Okay, so that was the end of that. Okay. The mind is said to be like a river that flows between two banks. One bank is positive and is the basis for liberation, while the other bank is negative and is the basis for indiscrimination and infatuations with sex objects. Right? So another indiscrimination is ignorance and infatuations is passion. Right? When the current of the river is controlled by practice and detachment, it tends to flow towards the side of liberation, abhyas, liberation. Abhyas, practice, means a particular type of effort or technique through which the mind attains stillness. Right? Because there's an anxiety when you're trying to learn something. Once you've learned it, the mind is peaceful. Right? So that's then the skill itself. Right? Practice does not mean engaging in mental gymnastics. It is, rather, sincere effort for maintaining steadiness of the mind. Perfection, so that steadiness of the mind means that everything else has to go along with it. So that's the yoga. It's because the body, the mind, the words have to be engaged together. Perfection in practice is attained through sincerity and persistence. Methods of practice will be discussed in conjunction with the discussion of the eight limbs of yoga. So methods of practice will be there, because this is where we're discussing the yoga process. So be there. But for us, it means it's the same. It'll be the same thing. We'll see the same elements. Okay. Vairagya, detachment or dispassion, does not mean to renounce the world or to withdraw oneself from one's environment. Rather, it means to have no expectations from external objects. Right? So most people take detachment means I'm not involved with it. But it means, no, that you don't expect any results from it. That's detachment. Because if it's your duty, then you perform it. But you're not attached to the result. Right? But to give up endeavor, then we consider that detachment. But Krishna is making that point. That's not actually the real renunciate. Right? It's not the person who who lights no fire and does no work. Right? Because lights no fire means he does no yajna. Right? There's no ritual. And he does no work. He doesn't do anything that creates economic development. But he's not the actual renounced person. Right? The actual renounced is when he's performing those activities without the desire for result. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Detachment means to eliminate identification with the evolutes of nature and to understand oneself as pure self, as a self-illuminating conscious being. Because you're identifying with the self. So it's not the self who's doing the work, it's the body who's doing the work. So if the body's supposed to be doing the work, the body does the work. But the soul is not attached to the results. Because the body is not attached to the results. It really isn't. You know? It's us who's attached to the results. It's the soul. Does that make sense? Like that. Patanjali also describes another method called Kriya Yoga to help students attain a higher state of consciousness while dealing with a restless mind. Kriya Yoga, which means the yoga of purification, is a threefold discipline composing of the practice of austerity, study of the scriptures, and surrender to God. By practicing the path of Kriya Yoga, students learn to perform their duties skillfully and selflessly while dedicating the fruits of their actions to the Supreme. So most, when you go to yoga places, they're all doing Kriya Yoga. And they'll also say they're doing Kriya Yoga. Like that, because they do this. Practice austerity, so they live a simple, ascetic lifestyle. They study the scriptures, and they surrender to God in whatever form they think God is. So that gets a little something like that.
That's what Yogananda proposes, Kriya Yoga.
Yeah, I think most of the, at least the yogis that are popular and have these studios that people are coming to, they're all doing Kriya Yoga, though they may give some other names, but it's actually Kriya is all they're doing. Because how many yoga studios you've gone to and found guys that are there in the, what do you call it? You have that lotus, but you have your hands behind your back, you're grabbing your toes. Another one?
It's called the yoga ceiling pose.
Yoga?
Ceiling pose.
Yeah. But so if you see them in that and they're bouncing around the room in that, not they're not these guys that are trying to levitate. But they're bouncing around because they've stopped the breathing and the body is freaking out and all that kind of stuff. Now you're talking the yogis that are going beyond just the hatha position and just the pranayama. They've gone to the point where they're stopping the breathing so they can go into the next stage of pulling in all the senses. So how many of those have you seen? How many of those have you heard about? No, it means you go up into the Himalayas and some weird other way place, you might see them. But otherwise, these yoga studios, technically, they're just all doing Kriya Yoga. So it's a preliminary. But at the same time, even though it's the preliminary, it's the easiest thing. So that's what we do. Practice of austerity, you perform your prescribed duties, you study the scriptures, and you surrender to Krishna. Right? Mm-hmm. Devotional process. So therefore, it's actually, even though it's the simplest, it's actually the essential points. And all these others are technical, because a lot of times, even though something's more technical, it's not necessarily that it's better. It's just more technical. But somebody will consider themselves more advanced because they're more technical. You know. Okay. By practicing the path of Kriya Yoga, students... students learn to perform their duties skillfully and selflessly while dedicating the fruits of their actions to the Supreme. So, therefore, you learn and you're skillful at it. You develop your skills. It's not that skills don't develop. So this idea is that you have to go to the modern to get skills. No, the point of yoga is that you perform your skills nicely. But they're according to austerity, which is your prescribed duties. Right? Why develop a skill that's not yours to do? Right?
But the yoga studios, aren't they just doing gymnastics?
Basically, no. You're talking about if you have a yoga... That was a yoga ashram.
Oh, okay.
When you go to an ashram where everybody's all dressed up in their saffron, the men and the women and everything. Yeah, and you know, of course they're married and all this. And they're doing karma yoga, right?
Yeah.
They're karma yogis. Karma sannyasis, right?
Yes.
You know? So you come and meet Swarupananda Saraswati, and it's a lady, right? You know, so like that. You know, it always is a lady, right? You know, head of the ashram is generally always is. Sometimes there's a man there, but he's got a big beard.
Yeah.
Like that, so. But if you don't have a big beard, then it should be a lady, right?
Yeah.
One or the other.
I mean, could be both.
Huh?
Could be both.
Well, a lot of times then, you know, he's the head of the ashram, but she's the manager of the ashram.
Yeah, I was thinking a lady with a beard.
Oh.
That's in Eastern Europe.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't been to any yoga studios over there, so I can't say. So, who has more experience on that side could tell us like that.
There are people we can consult here.
Okay. Like that. He can't think of any particular example right now. Okay. So here. The Eightfold Path of Yoga. So, in other words, we see that it's actually the same system, but all they're doing is applying it mechanically and on the Supersoul as opposed to Bhagavan. So if you apply the yoga system, you know, in its essence on Bhagavan, that's the Bhakti Yoga system.
Mm.
Right? Because all the Eightfold, all those things in that particular details we'll get into now, then that's the Ashtanga Yoga. But in principle, it's still the Bhakti Yoga.
Mm.
Right? So the Eightfold Path of Yoga. The Eightfold, eight components, Ashtanga, of this yoga system, see chart below, are restraints, yamas, observances, niyamas, postures, asana, breath control, pranayama, sense withdrawal, pratyahara, concentration, dharana, meditation, dhyana, and spiritual absorption, samadhi. So here in the chart, eight limbs of Patanjali Yoga. So yamas, so there's five restraints. Not hurting, ahimsa, not non-lying, satya. So therefore the prajalpa is breaking the principle of yama here. Non-stealing, right? Sense control, brahmacharya, non-possessiveness. So as we mentioned here, as remember Manu was saying about the essential points. So not hurting other animals, telling the truth, right? Not appropriating anybody else's goods, controlling the senses, and I forget what was he given the definition of the last one. But non-possessiveness. So even you don't take stuff that's not yours, even what you have, you don't consider it yours. Because if you do like that, it belongs to the Lord, it's your quota. If you think like that, then the whole Varnashram system will work nicely. Right? So these are the yamas as far as the qualities go. So we talk about all of these. Right? So ahimsa, the main thing is that it means understanding the soul. If you don't understand the soul, even you're dealing nicely with the person, still it's violence because you're dealing with them as the body. It means, in other words, it's the soul is not being addressed. You're only addressing the body. So actually, still, that's violent. Like that. Not lying means it's about God. Not that it's about something true. Satya means that it's about the Supreme. That's actually. So any fact in contact, connection with the Supreme, that's satya. But even if it's a fact, if it's not connected to the Supreme, it's still untruth. Right? Non-stealing means you don't. What's not yours, what's not within your duty, you know, you don't do. Like that. You don't do, you don't take. Right? Sensory control, brahmacharya, in other words, the senses are engaged properly in whatever our duties and whatever we're supposed to be doing. Right? That's brahmacharya. And non-possessiveness, we described, it belongs to God, it's our quota, we use it for God. Like that. Niyamas, five observances. Okay, austerity, study, and surrender is equals kriya yoga. I wonder why he put that there like that. You know, why is it there like that? You know? I mean, it's a good place for it, but why it's not given a bullet point?
Oh.
Or it's contained in the purity on all these. Oh, okay, study, surrender. Okay, so austerity would mean purity, contentment. Yeah, your purity, contentment, austerity. You'd have to be, because your austerity is your tapas, your performance of your prescribed duties. You should be contented with that, and you should be pure in performing that.
He puts also later on, yoga, you see later.
Oh, okay, okay. Okay, okay. It means up to what level, which aspect? So in other words, if you're following the niyamas, then that is kriya yoga. But at the same time, you should be cultivating the yamas. But even if you don't, you can do these, and then naturally they'll include the other. Because if you're pure, you're content, you're austere, then generally you won't be hurting anyone, lying, stealing, not controlling your senses, or being possessive. Yeah? Okay. Then study, swadhyaya, and surrender, Ishwara, paridhana. So here it's defined as Ishwara, surrendering to the Supreme. Right. So here there's the element of surrender to the Supreme. Well, in the other systems, now, either it means that they've accepted the Supreme, there's no surrender. There's recognizing his position, you know, trying to do things in a way that he's pleased, that you become liberated. But there's no concept of actually surrendering to the Supreme. So this is the first time we see that aspect comes up, right? Except in the, you know, the devotional Shankhya. But then that will be in, technically Vedanta. That's just like that. But here is the first time we see it. But we see is when it is, because before they're appreciating, but they're actually functioning on the Brahman level. So here they're surrendering to the Supreme, but only on the Paramatma level. And so they'll either move forward from Paramatma to Bhagavan, or they'll move back from Paramatma back to Brahman. Like that. Is that
interesting?
Right? Because Paramatma is the stage in between. It's the Lord, but it's not the Lord that has the personal feature of his associates and what he's doing, what he wants to be doing. He's creating, maintaining, and destroying the material world.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. That's Paramatma.
So your idea of the Supreme would always move towards either Brahman or Bhagavan?
Yes. It won't remain at Paramatma, because the point is that if it's a person doing it, so what about the person?
Yeah,
or if he's just doing this in the creation, maintenance, and instruction, those are Brahman terms. So then it moves back to there. So it has to go one way or the other. Okay, so then that was niyama, what you're supposed to do. Interesting, because yama is the restraint. So niyamas means what's not restrained. So austerity, purity, contentment, study, and surrender are not restrained. Right? You can unlimitedly do that. It's interesting how it goes. Asana, yoga postures, pranayama, control of vital force, prana, apana, samana, udana, and dhyana. From yamas to pranayama, that's hatha yoga. Dharana, withdrawal of the senses. Pratyahara, see, that can only be done when the life airs are controlled. Because the idea in yoga is, as long as the air is moving, you're breathing, then the mind is disturbed. Right? So when the breath, the ingoing breath goes into the outgoing breath, it doesn't mean you stop breathing, means, you know, you shoot yourself or something. It means you stop breathing, means you put the ingoing air into the outgoing air. And so then it just stops moving. The life air is still there, but it stopped moving. So when that happens, the mind will be peaceful. When the mind's peaceful, then you pull in all the senses. Right? So technically speaking, no one ever gets to that in these modern day yoga things. You know, you might have somebody up in the Himalayas doing that, but you're not going to see that in some studio somewhere. Not in 20 minutes at least. Good chance you're not going to get that. Right? It means you might withdraw your mind from thinking of work. You know, and because of that, you feel peaceful. But you haven't withdrawn it from everything.
They practice asanas only after yama
and niyama. No, but when you're doing pranayama and then that, you're in an asan. But the point is what you're trying to get yourself to is an asan that you can hold it for the next, 10 to 60,000 years. Right? So that takes some practice because the body is out of line and this and that. So that's why there's so many asanas you can do to perfectly get the body lined up so you can do that. The backbone has to be perfectly straight, and you have to be able to hold it like that. So you want to use one of those. So lotus is your standard one. But if you want to stand on your toes and the talasan, your backbone's also straight, like Hirani Kashipu did. That's a little harder. So it's only the best, right, for Hiranyakashipu. He's not about to do, sit down. Everybody else, all the small timers sit in the lotus position. Right? So you're going to do those things. So basically, your pratyahara, dharana, jhana, and samadhi are all done in a asan. So you have to have practiced the asana until you can do one asan perfectly. So they say you attain siddhi in an ashram asan. We can hold it for 2 hours, 45 minutes without disturbance. It's not like there's any pressure, it's just you can sit there perfectly for that long and you're not disturbed at all. Then you could say that asana's been perfected. Right? And that's just around here. We're not talking, Then you take it to the higher. I've also, sometimes you see it defined that hatha means you do a little bit of but there's not an emphasis of pranayama. When you emphasize pranayama, I think sometimes they call that raja yoga. But, it's a fine detail. But most practitioners of hatha yoga means they practice these first four. That's all. Okay, withdraw. So dharana, concentration, means you withdraw the senses, then the next is to focus the mind. And then the mind being focused, then there's dhyana, meditation. So then here, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, it means samyama. So these are the, when that's all done, then you come to samadhi. Because concentration is there, then concentration is on one point. So dhyana means it's one-pointed. Then from one-pointed, then you put the super soul there, and then you meditate on super soul until that becomes complete. Right? And then those five stages. We mentioned about, occasional to more regular to a constant, and then it becomes more deep, and then it turns into samadhi. Right? Like that. So that's what you're trying to get to. So, yeah. So when I was saying before about the eka, the difference between, what was it, the eka? Ekagra. And then the higher one?
Niruddha.
Niruddha would mean that eka would mean that you're focused, so you're just doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're not endeavoring after something material. But the niruddha. It would mean that now you've come to these positions of dhyana and samadhi. Right? So ekagra means you're able to do the mechanical processes and get it to there. But once you get to dhyana, there's no mechanics anymore. Like that. But before, there's mechanics. Those subtler and subtler. Like that. Success in yoga requires a one-pointed and well-controlled mind, free from all worldly desires. Attachment to worldly objects is the main cause of and is the direct evolute of ignorance, which produces all the modifications of the mind. Right? So it's due to ignorance that all these modifications are there. Yes?
Where did it go from ekagra to niruddha?
From what I can see is by the definition in the Gita, then Dhyana and Samadhi are the advanced stages. So that's why we're using there. Though, at the same time, you can't do Dhyana without Dharana. You know. So in other words, we're taking it and splitting it. It's being split here. That Dharana is, you know, you're concentrating. So then concentrating on the super soul, then on there. But in the other, they're taking it. The Dharana is you're still, it's in other words, it's between what's mechanical and what's not. Because there, still, you're trying to focus it on one point. Once you've got it, where it's always on one point, then you put the super soul.
Yeah.
Right. So that then starts these higher two. Okay. But you have to have that one point of concentration to be able to do some yama.
Okay.
Okay. According to Patanjali Yoga, attachment to worldly objects worldly objects is the arch enemy of the individual who wants to understand his inner self. The necessary qualities conditions for reaching the subtler levels of consciousness include willpower, discrimination, full control of the mind, conscious direction of one's potentials towards the desired end, a firm resolution to turn away from all worldly attachments, determination to obliterate the ego, control over all inharmonious processes, and constant awareness of the ultimate goal. Okay, so 13, footnote. Bhagavad Gita 6:24, it is stated, one should engage oneself in the practice of yoga with determination and faith and not be deviated from the path. One should abandon, without exception, all material desires born of mental speculation, and thus control all the senses and all sides by the mind. Srila Prabhupada explains, the yoga practitioner should be determined and should patiently prosecute the practice without deviation. One should be sure of success at the end and pursue this course with great perseverance, not becoming discouraged if there is any delay in the attainment of success. Success is sure for the rigid practitioner. Regarding bhakti yoga, Rupa Goswami says, one can execute the process of bhakti yoga successfully with full-hearted enthusiasm, perseverance, and determination by following the prescribed duties in the association of devotees, by engaging completely in activities of goodness. Right, so one can get to that platform by doing one's prescribed duties in the association of devotees and what are recommended activities. In other words, I'm always performing recommended activities in the association of devotees. Right? Does that make sense? So then it will always...
Is that the birth you mentioned in the previous class?
This is Upadeshamrita 3. But then the one I mentioned was 8. Because there he's saying, all he's saying there is that the essence of all the instructions is this. So basically, this is bringing out these different, you know, aspects of it. So the Upadeshamrita itself is essence. But then within that, he gives the essence of the essence as that eighth verse. Like that. Because then from there, you can expand it out. Because name, form, qualities, pastimes, you can expand that into everything. Association of devotees, you can expand that into everything. You know, following the footsteps of the devotees and the authority, the scriptures, the parampara, all that all expands out of there. As for determination, one should follow the example of the sparrow who lost her eggs in the waves of the ocean. Similarly, the practice of yoga, especially bhakti yoga and Krishna consciousness, may appear to be a very difficult job. But if anyone follows the principles with great determination, the Lord will surely help, for God helps those who help themselves. So one may even say in the modern day, it's more difficult is bhakti yoga than the other yoga systems. Because the other yoga systems are not taking that full surrender, all these different elements, so seriously. So because the process of devotional service is not actually very difficult. It's the process of surrender that's more difficult. Really? Does that make sense? While others may have a more difficult physical kind of situation, but mentally it's easier. So one can put up with more physical problem than one can with emotion. Right? The mental. So that's why I probably use it, especially bhakti yoga. may appear to be a very difficult job, but for what you're getting, it's actually the easiest. Because even though it's harder, the other yoga process seems emotionally or mentally easier. What you're getting is very minimal. So all that extra endeavor. But the point is, bhakti yoga, then what you're getting is unlimitedly greater. So therefore, it's actually an easier process. Though it appears maybe to be harder. Yes.
Isn't the argument that they say that it's only sentimentalists who just say, okay, we're doing devotion, because then it's easy, because we're doing the really hard stuff, the yoga is the really hard process.
Yeah, like that. But the point is they're taking it because the devotion is actually harder for them. Because in other words, it's easier for them to do something that's physically difficult. They see some of the big false ego, it's not difficult for them to do something physically tough. Right? You know, who's the guy that jumps off the top of the cliff, you know, and you got, you know, a 3-foot gap there, and then the wave has to come in that you hit it right. It's the guy with the false ego. You know what I'm saying? So it's more difficult, but he's got the false ego, goes with him. You know? Like that. So it's actually harder for them to take up bhakti than it would be to do what they're doing. Because they got the ego, so therefore those hard things, oh, we're doing the real thing. But the point is if I said, okay, here, try this. Here's a wall here. We want to get on the other side of this wall. Now you can take your head and bang your head on here, and I'll show you special techniques of how you can do it and this and that. Or you could just walk around the wall. No, but we're the serious guys. We're not the sentimentalists. They just walk around the wall and all that. You know, we really, you know, sit there and bang our head and really, you know, like that. It's tough. It's hard. So if you look at it in that context, then you have to. There has to be something wrong. Why would you choose that when there's an easier way? You know what I'm saying? If I said, okay, you want a drink? Okay, here's a machine right here. Or there's a machine way over there, right? And the escalator doesn't work. You're going to have to walk up it. Oh, no, I'm going there. Yeah, that drink's better. Yeah, no, it's the same drink. You know, just get it from here. Like that. So it's false ego. So it's only false ego that they pride themselves in a more difficult path. That's all. But the point is because of false ego, they can't do the simpler. It's too easy. No, they have to do. They're special. They do something unique and different. Right. But that's the point. We're not big guys. We're 1/10,000 the tip of the hair. We're the servants of God. You know.
Still, that's the point where the most difficulty comes.
Yeah, is in giving up that false ego, because you know the reason we're here is because we think we are God. So, you know, the difference is they either don't know they have that, or they're attached to that. While we know we have it, we're not attached to it in principle, that we know we want to get rid of it by practice, or by habit, not by practice. By habit, we are attached to it. So that's the difficulty. You know? Because that's the thing, is that, yeah. You know, because people leave Krishna consciousness, give up the process because of false ego. Either karma or jnana, right? You know, it's like, you know, it's that, you know, these things, this or that, or so many things in authority, and I'm the authority, and all this and that kind of thing. Or it's that, what was it? Remembering? Fond memories of sense gratification. And so then that's, you know what I'm saying? It's not because the process doesn't have anything to offer. It's just that these other two, the ego's too big, or there's too much. Ego's too big and I'm the controller, or ego's too big and I'm the enjoyer. Like that. But if one is able to give up, I'm the controller and the enjoyer, then the process works really simple, very easy. That's what it says. Krishna says, blissfully performed. But the only thing that gets in the way of the bliss is that I'm the controller and enjoyer. That's the big problem. Like that. So yeah. Okay. So then tomorrow we'll go through this. Where it goes through in detail each one of them. Oh, it goes through. Oh, okay. So it just goes through the whole what each one of them is in detail. Okay, so that was like the introduction. So this should be quite interesting. Right? I mean, for the jnani, right? You know? Everybody else, then you're going to get bored for the next few days. Right? You know? No? Then, oh, then samyama. Okay, so that's why I put that in, because samyama is the final step. Then we get into karma mimamsa. Okay.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nityananda, Gaur Premanandi.